young Count as an example of courageous perseverance in the face of impossible odds, the Count had always suspected it was a little apocryphal. After all, in the midst of armed conflicts, facts are bound to be just as susceptible to injury as ships and men, if not more so. But at the onset of the summer solstice of 1954, the one-eyed cat of the Metropole turned his blind eye upon the Count's ill-gotten gains, and, without the slightest expression of disappointment, disappeared down the stairs. Apotheoses. Despite having gone to bed at 4 in the morning, on the 21st of June the Count rose at his usual hour. He did 5 squats, 5 stretches, and took 5 deep breaths. He breakfasted on coffee, a biscuit, and his daily fruit, today an assortment of berries, after which he went downstairs to read the papers and chat with Vasily. He lunched in the piazza. In the afternoon, he paid a visit to Marina in the stitching room. As it was his day off, at 7 o'clock he had an aperitif at the Chaliapin, where he marvelled at the arrival of summer with the ever-attentive Odrius. And at 8, he dined at table 10 in the Boyarsky. Which is to say, he treated the day much as he treated any other. Except that when he left the restaurant at 10, having told Nadja that the manager wished to see her, he slipped inside the empty coat room in order to borrow the raincoat and fedora of the American journalist, Salisbury. Back on the 6th floor, the Count dug to the bottom of his old trunk in order to retrieve the rucksack that he had used in 1918 on his trek from Paris to Idlehour. As on that journey, this time he would travel only with the bare necessities. That is, 3 changes of clothing, a toothbrush and toothpaste, Anna Karenina, Mishka's project and, finally, the bottle of Chateauneuf de Pape that he intended to drink on the 14th of June 1963, 10 years to the day after his old friend's death. Gathering up his things, the Count paid one last visit to his study. So many years before, he had bid adieu to a whole household. Then, a few years later, he had bid adieu to a suite. Now, he was to bid adieu to a room that was 100 feet square. It was, without question, the smallest room that he had occupied in his life. Yet somehow, within those 4 walls, the world had come and gone. With that thought, the Count tipped his hat to Helena's portrait and switched out the light. At the same time that the Count was descending to the lobby, Sophia was concluding her performance on the stage of the Salle Pleyel in Paris. Rising from the piano, she turned to the audience almost in a state of wonder. For whenever Sophia performed, she so fully immersed herself in her playing that she tended to forget there was anyone listening. But having been brought back to her senses by the sound of applause, she did not forget to gesture graciously toward the orchestra and her conductor before taking 1 final bow. Immediately off stage, Sophia received a formal congratulations from the cultural attaché and a heartfelt embrace from director Vavilov. "It was her finest performance yet," he said. But then the 2 men turned their attention back to the stage, where the violin prodigy was taking his place before the conductor. The hall grew so quiet that all assembled could hear the tap of the conductor's baton. Then, after that universal moment of suspension, the musicians began to play and Sophia made her way to the dressing room. The conservatory's orchestra performed Dvorak's concerto in just over 30 minutes. Sophia would allow herself 15 to reach the exit. Taking up her knapsack, she went straight to one of the bathrooms reserved for the musicians. Locking the door behind her, she kicked off her shoes and shed the beautiful blue dress that Marina had made. She took off the necklace that Anna had given her and dropped it on the dress. She donned the slacks and Oxford shirt that her father had purloined from the Italian gentleman. Then, looking into the small mirror above the sink, she took out the scissors that her father had given her and began to cut her hair. This little implement in the shape of an egret, which had been so prized by her father's sister, had clearly been designed for snipping, not shearing. The rings cut into the knuckles of Sophia's thumb and forefinger as she tried and failed to cut through lengths of her hair. Beginning to shed tears of frustration, Sophia closed her eyes and took a breath. "There is no time for that," she told herself. Wiping the tears from her cheeks with the back of her hand, she began again, cutting smaller amounts of hair, working systematically around her head. When she was finished, she swept up the hair with her hands and flushed it down the toilet, just as her father had instructed. Then, from a side pocket in the knapsack, she took the little black bottle that the barber of the Metropole had once used to dye those first grey hairs that appeared in his customers' beards. The cap of the bottle had a small brush attached to it. Taking in hand the strip of white hair that had virtually defined her appearance since the age of 13, Sophia leaned over the sink and carefully brushed it with the dye until it was as black as the rest of her hair. When she was done, she returned the bottle and the scissors to her pack. She took out the Italian's cap and set it on the sink. Then she shifted her attention to the pile of clothes on the floor. And that is when she realized they had never considered her shoes. All she had was the elegant pair of high-heeled pumps that Anna had helped pick out for the conservatory competition the year before. With little choice, she dumped them in the trash. She scooped up the dress and necklace to dispose of them as well. Yes, Marina had made the dress, and Anna had given her the necklace. But she couldn't take them with her. Of that, her father had left no doubt. If for any reason she was stopped and her bag was searched, these glamorous feminine items would give her away. Sophia hesitated for a moment, then she stuffed the dress into the trash with the shoes, but the necklace she slipped into her pocket. Securing the straps of the knapsack and swinging it onto her back, Sophia pulled the cap tightly onto her head, opened the bathroom door, and listened. The strings were beginning to swell, signalling the end of the third movement. Leaving the bathroom, she turned away from the dressing rooms and headed toward the back of the building. The music grew louder as she passed directly behind the stage. Then, with the first notes of the final movement, she passed through the exit at the rear of the hall and went barefoot into the night. Walking quickly, but not running, Sophia circled the Salle Pleyel to the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, where the well-lit entrance of the concert hall was located. Crossing the street, she stepped into a doorway and took off the Italian's cap. From under the brim, she pulled out the little map that her father had cut from the Baedeker and folded into the size of a matchbook. Opening it, she oriented herself and then began following the red line half a block along Faubourg Saint-Honoré, down the Avenue Auge to the Arc de Triomphe, and then left onto the Champs-Élysées, headed toward the Place de la Concorde. In drawing this zigzagging line from the doors of the Salle Pleyel to the American Embassy, the Count had not chosen the most direct route. That would have been 10 blocks straight along Faubourg Saint-Honoré. But the Count had wanted to get Sophia away from the concert hall as quickly as possible. This slight detour would add only a few minutes to Sophia's journey, but it would allow her to disappear into the anonymity of the Champs-Élysées, and she should still have enough time to reach the embassy before her absence was discovered. But when the Count had made this calculation, what he had failed to take into account was the impact upon a 21-year-old girl of seeing the Arc de Triomphe and the Louvre lit up at night for the very first time. True, Sophia had seen them both the day before, along with plenty of other sights. But just as the Count had imagined, she had seen them through the window of a bus. It was a different thing altogether to see them at the onset of summer, having received an ovation, changed one's appearance, and escaped into the night. For while in the classical tradition there was no muse of architecture, I think we can agree that under the right circumstances, the appearance of a building can impress itself upon one's memory, affect one's sentiments, and even change one's life. Just so, risking minutes that she did not have to spare, Sophia came to a stop at the Place de la Concorde and turned slowly in place, as if in a moment of recognition. On the night before she had left Moscow, when Sophia had expressed her distress at what her father wanted her to do, he had attempted to console her with a notion. He had said that our lives are steered by uncertainties, many of which are disruptive or even daunting, but that if we persevere and remain generous of heart, we may be granted a moment of supreme lucidity, a moment in which all that has happened to us suddenly comes into focus as a necessary course of events, even as we find ourselves on the threshold of a bold new life that we had been meant to lead all along. When her father had made this claim, it had seemed so outlandish, so overblown, that it had not assuaged Sophia's distress in the least. But turning in place on the Place de la Concorde, seeing the Arc de Triomphe and the Eiffel Tower, and the Tuileries, and the cars and Vespers zipping around the great obelisk, Sophia had an inkling of what her father had been trying to say. "Was it like this all night?" Richard van der Waal, who was standing in his apartment in the embassy, had just noticed the angle of his bow tie in the bedroom mirror. It was at a slant of 25 degrees. "Your tie is always like that, my dear." Richard turned to his wife in shock. "Always? Why on earth haven't you ever said anything?" "Because I think it makes you look rakish." Giving the nod of one who could make do with rakish, Richard took another look in the mirror, then pulled the tie loose, hung his tuxedo jacket on the back of his chair, and was about to suggest a nightcap when there was a knock at the door. It was Richard's attaché. "What is it, Billy?" "I'm sorry to bother you at this hour, sir, but there is a young man asking for you."
"A young man?"
"Yes. Apparently he is seeking asylum." Richard raised his eyebrows.
"Asylum from what?"
"I'm not certain, sir, but he isn't wearing any shoes."
Mr. and Mrs. van der Waal exchanged looks.
"Well, then, I guess you had better show him in."
The attaché returned a minute later with a young man in a newsboy's cap who was, in fact, barefoot. In the manner of the polite but anxious, the young man took off his cap and held it at his waist in both hands.
"Billy," said Mrs. van der Waal, "this is not a young man."
The attaché's eyes widened.
"Well, I'll be damned," said Richard. "Sophia Rostov."
Sophia smiled with an expression of relief.
"Mr. van der Waal."
Richard told his attaché he could go, then he approached Sophia with a grin and took her by the elbows.
"Let me get a good look at you."
Without letting go of Sophia, Richard turned to his wife.
"Didn't I tell you she was a beauty?"
"You certainly did,"
said Mrs. van der Waal with a smile. Although from Sophia's perspective, it was Mrs. van der Waal who was the beauty.
"What a terrific turn of events," said Richard.
"You weren't expecting me?"
asked Sophia tentatively.
"Of course we were, but your father has grown quite fond of all this cloak-and-dagger business. He assured me that you were coming, but he wouldn't let me know when, where, or how. And he certainly didn't tell me you'd be arriving as a barefoot boy."
Richard pointed to Sophia's knapsack.
"Is that all you brought with you?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Are you hungry?"
asked Mrs. van der Waal. Before Sophia could respond, Richard chimed in.
"Of course she's hungry. I'm hungry, and I've just returned from a dinner. I'll tell you what, my dear. Why don't you see if you can scare up some clothes for Sophia while she and I have a chat? Then we can all rendezvous in the kitchen.
While Mrs. van der Waal went in search of clothes, Richard led Sophia into his study and sat on the edge of his desk.
I can't tell you how excited we are to have you in house, Sophia. And I do so hate putting business before pleasure. But once we sit down to eat, I suspect we'll be swept away with stories of your adventures. So, before we go to the kitchen, your father mentioned that you might have something for me.
Sophia looked shy and hesitant.
My father said that you might have something for me first.
Richard laughed and slapped his hands together.
Right you are. I'd forgotten all about it.
Richard crossed the room to one of the bookcases. Standing on his tiptoes, he reached to the uppermost shelf and removed what looked like a large book, but which turned out to be a package wrapped in brown paper. Richard set it down on his desk with a thud. In turn, Sophia began to reach into her knapsack.
"Before giving anything to me," Richard cautioned, "you should probably make sure that this is what it's supposed to be."
"Oh, yes, I see."
"Besides," he added, "I've been dying of curiosity."
Joining Richard at his desk, Sophia untied the strings and pulled back the folds of paper. Inside was an old edition of Montaigne's essays.
"Well," said Richard, a little bemused, "you've got to give that old Frenchman credit. He's substantially heavier than Adam Smith or Plato. I really had no idea."
But then Sophia opened the book, revealing a rectangular cavity cut into the pages, in which there were 8 small stacks of gold coins.
"Naturally," said Richard.
Sophia closed the book and retied the strings. Then, taking off her knapsack, she emptied its contents onto a chair and handed the empty bag to Richard.
"Father said you should cut the seam at the top of the straps."
There was a knock at the door, and Mrs. van der Waal poked in her head.
"I've got some clothes to show you, Sophia. Are you ready?"
"Perfect timing," said Richard, while giving a nod to Sophia. "I'll follow you in a minute."
Left alone, Richard took a penknife from his pocket. He switched out the blade and carefully cut the seam that had been expertly sewn along the top of the shoulder straps. In the narrow gap that ran behind the length of one of the straps had been slipped a tightly rolled piece of paper. Easing the roll from its hiding place, Richard sat down and spread it across his desk. On the top side there was a diagram entitled "Combined Dinner of Council of Ministers and Presidium, June 11th, 1954. The diagram itself depicted a long U with 46 names inscribed around its periphery. Under the name of each person was their title and a summation of their personality in 3 words. On the verso was a detailed description of the evening in question. Certainly, the Count described the announcement concerning the Obinsk nuclear power plant and the theatric display of its connection to the Moscow grid, but what he emphasized in the course of his report were the evening's social nuances. First, the Count observed that when the guests appeared at the dinner, virtually all were surprised by the venue. They had obviously arrived at the hotel expecting they would be dining in one of the Boyarsky's formal rooms, only to be directed instead to Suite 417. The one exception was Khrushchev, who entered the room with the cool satisfaction of one who not only knew where the dinner would be held, but was pleased to see that everything was perfectly in order. The General Secretary erased any doubt as to his personal involvement in the planning of the evening when, having been unusually quiet, he stood at 11:10 to make a toast that referenced the history of the suite 2 floors below. But for the Count, the genius of the evening was in Khrushchev's casual display of his alignment with Malyshev. In recent months, Malenkov had made no secret of his disagreement with Khrushchev regarding nuclear armament. Malenkov foresaw that a nuclear arms race with the West could only have devastating results, referring to it as an apocalyptic policy. But with this little event of political theatre, Khrushchev had performed the perfect sleight of hand, switching out the threat of nuclear Armageddon for the uplifting sight of a city sparkling with nuclear power. In a stroke, the conservative hawk had cast himself as a man of the future and his progressive opponent as a reactionary. Sure enough, with the lights of the city shining brightly and freshly chilled bottles of vodka on the table, Malyshev crossed the room to confer with the General Secretary. As most of the others were still milling about with smiles on their faces, Malyshev quite naturally took the empty chair at Khrushchev's side. So, when everyone began to resume their places, Malenkov found himself stranded behind Khrushchev and Malyshev. And as the Premier of the Communist Party waited awkwardly for them to finish their conversation so that he could reclaim his seat, no one at the table even batted an eye. As Richard finished reading the Count's description, he leaned back in his chair and smiled, thinking he could use 100 men like Alexander Rostov. And that's when he noticed the small, slightly curled piece of paper lying on his desk. Picking it up, Richard immediately recognized the Count's cursive. The note, which had presumably been rolled up in the report, included a straightforward instruction of how to confirm that Sophia had arrived at the embassy safely, followed by a long sequence of 7-digit numbers. Richard jumped to his feet.
"Billy!"
After a moment, the door swung open and the attaché stuck in his head.
"Sir? If it is almost 10 in Paris, what time is it in Moscow?"
"Midnight."
"How many girls are on the switchboard?"
"I'm not certain," admitted the lieutenant, a little flustered. "At this hour, 2, maybe 3.
"That's not enough. Go to the typing pool, the decoding room, the kitchen. Round up everyone with a finger on their hand."
When the Count arrived in the lobby with his rucksack on his shoulder and sat in his chair between the potted palms, he didn't fidget. He didn't get up and walk about, or read the evening edition, nor did he check the time on the bishop's watch. If asked in advance to imagine what sitting there under these circumstances would feel like, the Count would have predicted a definite sense of anxiety. But as the minutes ticked away, the Count didn't find the wait distressing at all. He found it surprisingly peaceful. With a patience that was almost otherworldly, he watched the guests of the hotel come and go. He saw the elevator doors open and close. He heard the sound of music and laughter emanating from the Shalyapin bar. At that moment, it somehow seemed to the Count that no one was out of place, that every little thing happening was part of some master plan, and that within the context of that plan, he was meant to sit in the chair between the potted palms and wait. And almost exactly at midnight, the Count's patience was rewarded. For in accordance with the instructions he'd written to Richard, every telephone on the first floor of the Metropole began to ring. All 4 telephones at the main desk rang. The 2 house phones that were on a side table by the elevator rang. The telephones at Vasily's desk and the bell captain's station rang, as did the 4 telephones in the piazza, the 3 in the coffee house, the 8 in the executive offices, and the 2 on the bishop's desk. All told, there must have been 30 phones ringing at once. What a simple thing in concept, the simultaneous ringing of 30 phones. And yet, it immediately created a sense of pandemonium. Those who were in the lobby began looking from corner to corner. What could bring about the ringing of 30 phones at 12 o'clock at night? Had the Metropole been struck by lightning? Was Russia under attack? Or were the spirits of the past exacting their toll on the present? Whatever the cause, the sound was utterly disconcerting. When a single telephone rings, our immediate instinct is to pick up the receiver and say hello. But when 30 ring at once, our instinct is to take 2 steps back and stare. The limited crew of the night shift found themselves running from phone to phone without the fortitude to answer a single one. The drunken crowd in the Shalyapin began spilling into the lobby as guests, who had been awakened on the second floor, came marching down the stairs. And in the midst of this commotion, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov quietly donned the journalist's hat and coat, shouldered his rucksack, and walked out of the Metropole Hotel. Afterward. Afterwards. On the 21st of June 1954, Viktor Stepanovich Skodovsky left his apartment shortly before midnight in order to keep an appointment. His wife had urged him not to go. What good could come from an appointment at this hour, she wanted to know. Did he think the police didn't walk the streets at midnight? The police made a point of walking the streets at midnight. Because since the beginning of time, that's when fools have kept their appointments. Viktor responded to his wife that this was nonsense, that she was being melodramatic. But when he left their building, he walked 10 blocks to the Garden Ring before boarding a bus, and he took comfort from the indifference with which the others on the bus received him. Yes, his wife was upset that he had an appointment at midnight, but if she had known the purpose of the appointment, she would have been beside herself. And if, upon learning of his intentions, she had demanded to know why on earth he had agreed to do something so foolhardy, he wouldn't have been able to answer her. He wasn't certain himself. It wasn't simply because of Sophia. Of course, he felt an almost fatherly pride in her achievement as a pianist. The very notion of helping a young artist discover her talent was a fantasy that Viktor had long since abandoned, and to experience it so unexpectedly was beyond description. What's more, it was the hours of teaching Sophia that had ultimately led him to pursue another abandoned dream, playing the classical repertoire in a chamber orchestra. But even so, it wasn't simply because of her. To a greater degree, it was because of the Count, for, however unaccountably, Viktor felt a profound sense of loyalty to Alexander Ilyich Rostov, a sense of loyalty that was grounded in feelings of respect that Viktor could hardly articulate, and that his wife, for all her virtues, would never have understood. But perhaps most of all, he had agreed to the Count's request because it felt right to do so, and that feeling of conviction, in itself, was a pleasure that had become increasingly rare. With that thought, Viktor stepped off the bus, entered the old St. Petersburg station, and walked across the central hall toward the brightly lit cafe where he had been instructed to wait. Viktor was sitting in a booth in the corner, watching an old accordion player move from table to table, when the Count entered the cafe. He was wearing an American trench coat and a dark grey fedora. Seeing Viktor, he crossed the cafe, set down his rucksack, shed the coat and hat, and joined him in the booth. When a moment later the waitress appeared, he ordered a cup of coffee, and then waited for the coffee to arrive before sliding a little red book across the table. "I want to thank you for doing this," he said. "You needn't thank me, Your Excellency." "Please, Viktor. Call me Alexander." Viktor was about to ask if the Count had received any word from Sophia, but he was interrupted by a scuffle on the other side of the cafe. 2 haggard-looking fruit sellers carrying woven baskets had gotten into a territorial dispute. Given that it was so late, both men were down to a few sorry pieces of produce, and while this may have lent an air of futility to their argument in the eyes of the observers, it in no way diminished the stakes for the principals. To that end, after a brief exchange of insults, one struck the other in the face. With blood on his lip and fruit on the floor, the assaulted man responded in kind. As the customers in the café stopped their conversations to watch the skirmish with weary, knowing expressions, the café's manager rounded the bar and dragged the combatants out by their collars. For a moment, the room was silent while everyone stared out the café window to the spot where the two fruit sellers remained sitting on the ground a few feet apart. Then, all of a sudden, the old accordion player, who had stopped performing during the scuffle, struck up a friendly tune, presumably in the hopes of restoring some sense of goodwill. As Victor took a sip from his coffee, the Count watched the accordion player with interest.
"Have you ever seen Casablanca?" he asked.
Somewhat bewildered, Victor admitted that he had not.
"Ah, you must see it one day."
And so the Count told Victor about his friend Ossip and their recent viewing of the movie. In particular, he described the scene in which a small-time crook was dragged away by the police, and how the American saloon-keeper, having assured his customers that everything was all right, casually instructed his bandleader to play on.
"My friend was very impressed with this," explained the Count. "He saw the saloon-keeper's instruction to the piano player to start playing so soon after the arrest as evidence of his indifference to the fates of other men. But I wonder..."
The following morning at 11:30, two officers of the KGB arrived at the Metropole Hotel in order to question head waiter Alexander Rostov on an undisclosed matter. Having been escorted by a bellhop to Rostov's room on the 6th floor, the officers found no sign of him there. Nor was he receiving a trim in the barbershop, lunching at the piazza, or reading the papers in the lobby. Several of Rostov's closest associates, including Chef Zakovsky and Maitre d' Duras, were questioned, but none had seen Rostov since the previous night. The officers also endeavoured to speak with the hotel's manager, only to find that he had not yet reported to work, a fact that was duly noted in his file. At 1 o'clock, two additional KGB men were summoned so that a more thorough search could be made of the hotel. At 2, the senior officer conducting the investigation was encouraged to speak with Vasily, the concierge. Finding him at his desk in the lobby, where he was in the midst of securing theatre tickets for a guest, the officer did not beat about the bush. He put his question to the concierge unambiguously.
"Do you know the whereabouts of Alexander Rostov?"
To which the concierge replied,
"I haven't the slightest idea."
Having learned that both manager Leplevsky and head waiter Rostov had gone missing, Chef Zhukovsky and Maitre d' Duras convened at 2:15 for their daily meeting in the chef's office, where they immediately engaged in close conversation. To be perfectly frank, there was little time spent on consideration of manager Leplevsky's absence, but there was a good deal of time spent on head waiter Rostov's. Initially concerned when they had received word of their friend's disappearance, the two members of the triumvirate took comfort from the KGB's obvious frustration, for it confirmed that the Count was not in their grips. But the question remained, where could he possibly be? Then a certain rumour began to spread among the hotel staff. For though the officers of the KGB were trained to be inscrutable, gestures, language, and facial expressions have a fundamentally unruly syntax. Thus, over the course of the morning, implications had slipped out and inferences had been made that Sophia had gone missing in Paris.
"Is it possible?"
wondered André aloud, clearly implying to Emile that their friend may also have escaped into the night. As it was only 2:25, and Chef Zhukovsky had yet to turn the corner from pessimist to optimist, he curtly replied,
"Of course not."
This led to a debate between the two men on the differences between what was probable, plausible, and possible. A debate that might have gone on for an hour, but for a knock at the door. Responding with an irritated, "Yes?" Emil turned, expecting to find Ilya with his wooden spoon. But it was the clerk from the mailroom. The chef and maitre d' were so confounded by his sudden appearance that they simply stared.
"Are you Chef Zhukovsky and maitre d' Durand?"
he asked after a moment.
"Of course we are," declared the chef. "Who else would we be?"
Without a word, the clerk presented two of the five envelopes that had been dropped in his slot the night before, having already made visits to the seamstress's office, the bar, and the concierge's desk. A professional through and through, the clerk showed no curiosity as to the contents of these letters, despite their unusual weight. And he certainly didn't wait around for them to be opened, having plenty of his own work to attend to, thank you very much. With the mail clerk's departure, Emil and Andre looked down at their respective envelopes in wonder. In an instant, they could see that the letters had been addressed in a script that was at once proper, proud, and open-hearted. Meeting each other's gaze, they raised their eyebrows, then tore the envelopes open. Inside, they each found a letter of parting that thanked them for their fellowship, assured them that the night of the bouillabaisse would never be forgotten, and asked that they accept the enclosed as a small token of undying friendship. The enclosed happened to be 4 gold coins. The two men, who had opened their letters at the same time and read them at the same time, now dropped them on the table at the same time.
"It's true," gasped Emil.
A man of discretion and civility, Andre did not for one second consider saying,
"I told you so."
Although, with a smile, he did observe, "So it seems." But when Emil had recovered from these happy surprises, 4 pieces of gold and an old friend purposefully at large, he shook his head as one forlorn.
"What is it?"
asked Andre in concern.
"With Alexander gone, and you afflicted with palsy," the chef said, "what is to become of me?"
Andre looked at the chef for a moment, then smiled.
"Afflicted with palsy? My friend, my hands are as agile as they have ever been."
Then, to prove his point, Andre picked up the 4 gold catherines and sent them spinning in the air. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, in a nicely appointed office of the Kremlin, with a view of the lilacs in the Alexander Gardens, no less, the chief administrator of a special branch of the country's elaborate security apparatus sat behind his desk, reviewing a file. Dressed in a dark grey suit, the chief administrator might have been described as relatively indistinguishable when compared to any other balding bureaucrat in his early 60s, were it not for the scar above his left ear where, by all appearances, someone had once attempted to cleave his skull. When there was a knock at his door, the chief administrator called,
"Come in."
The knocker was a young man in a shirt and tie, bearing a thick brown folder.
"Yes?"
said the chief administrator to his lieutenant, while not looking up from his work.
"Sir," the lieutenant replied, "word was received early this morning that a student on the Moscow Conservatory's goodwill tour has gone missing in Paris."
The chief administrator looked up.
"A student from the Moscow Conservatory?"
"Yes, sir."
"Male or female?"
"A young woman."
"What is her name?"
The lieutenant consulted the folder in his hands.
"Her given name is Sophia, and she resides in the Metropole Hotel, where she has been raised by one Alexander Rostov, a former person under house arrest, although there appears to be some question as to her paternity."
"I see. And has this Rostov been questioned?"
"That is just it, sir. Rostov cannot be found either."
An initial search of the hotel's premises proved fruitless, and no one who has been questioned has admitted to seeing him since last night. However, a second and more thorough search this afternoon resulted in the discovery of the hotel's manager, locked in a storeroom in the basement.
Not Comrade Leplevsky?
The very same, sir. It appears that he discovered the plan of the girl's defection and was on his way to inform the KGB when Rostov overcame him and forced him into the storeroom at gunpoint.
At gunpoint?
Yes, sir.
Where did Rostov get a firearm?
It appears that he had a pair of antique dueling pistols, and the will to use them. In fact, it has been confirmed that he shot a portrait of Stalin in the manager's office.
Shot a portrait of Stalin? Well, he does sound like a rather ruthless fellow.
Yes, sir. And, if I may say so, wily. For it appears that 2 nights ago, a Finnish passport and Finnish currency were stolen from one of the hotel's Finnish guests. Then, last night, a raincoat and hat were stolen from an American journalist. This afternoon, investigators were sent to Leningradsky railway station, where confirmation was obtained that a man wearing the hat and coat in question was seen boarding the overnight train to Helsinki. The hat and coat were discovered in a washroom at the Russian terminus, in Viborg, along with a travel guide for Finland from which the maps had been removed. Given the tightness of security at the railway crossing into Finland, it is presumed that Rostov disembarked in Viborg in order to cross the border on foot. Local security has been alerted, but he may already have slipped through their fingers.
I see, said the chief administrator again, accepting the file from his lieutenant and putting it on his desk. But tell me, how did we make the connection between Rostov and the Finnish passport in the first place?
Comrade Leplevsky, sir.
How so?
When Comrade Leplevsky was led to the basement, he witnessed Rostov taking the Finnish guide from a collection of abandoned books. With that piece of information in hand, the connection was quickly made to the theft of the passport, and officers were dispatched to the station.
Excellent work all around, said the chief administrator.
Yes, sir, though it does make one wonder.
But wonder what?
Why Rostov didn't shoot Leplevsky when he had the chance.
Obviously, said the chief administrator. He didn't shoot Leplevsky, because Leplevsky isn't an aristocrat.
Sir?
Oh, never mind.
As the chief administrator tapped the new folder with his fingers, the lieutenant lingered in the doorway.
Yes? Is there something else?
No, sir. There is nothing else. But how shall we proceed? The chief administrator considered this question for a moment, and then, leaning back in his chair with the barest hint of a smile, replied,
Round up the usual suspects.
It was Viktor Stepanovich, of course, who left the damning evidence in the Viborg terminal washroom. An hour after bidding the count goodbye, he boarded the Helsinki-bound train wearing the journalist's hat and coat, with the Baedeker in his pocket. When he disembarked in Viborg, he tore out the maps and left the guide with the other items on a counter in the station's washroom. Then he travelled back on the next train bound for Moscow, empty-handed. It was almost a year later when Viktor finally had the opportunity to watch Casablanca. Naturally, when the scene shifted to Rick's Cafe and the police began closing in on Ugarte, his interest was piqued, because he remembered his conversation with the Count in the railway station cafe. So, with utmost attention, he watched as Rick disregarded Ugarte's pleas for help. He saw the saloon keeper's expression remain cool and aloof when the police dragged Ugarte from his lapels. But then, as Rick began making his way through the disconcerted crowd toward the piano player, something caught Victor's eye. Just the slightest detail, not more than a few frames of film. In the midst of this short journey, as Rick passes a customer's table, without breaking stride or interrupting his assurances to the crowd, He sets upright a cocktail glass that had been knocked over during the skirmish.
Yes, thought Victor. That's it. Exactly.
For here was Casablanca, a far-flung outpost in a time of war, and here at the heart of the city, right under the sweep of the searchlights, was Rick's Café Américain, where the beleaguered could assemble for the moment to gamble and drink and listen to music, to conspire, console, and most importantly, hope. And at the center of this oasis was Rick. As the Count's friend had observed, the saloon keeper's cool response to Ugarte's arrest and his instruction for the band to play on could suggest a certain indifference to the fates of men. But in setting upright the cocktail glass in the aftermath of the commotion, didn't he also exhibit an essential faith that, by the smallest of one's actions, one can restore some sense of order to the world? And anon. On one of the first afternoons of summer in 1954, a tall man in his 60s stood in the high grass among some ragged apple trees, somewhere in the Nizhny Novgorod province. The beginnings of a beard on his chin, the dirt on his boots, and the rucksack on his back all contributed to the impression that the man had been hiking for several days, though he didn't look weary from the effort. Pausing among the trees, the traveller looked a few paces ahead, to where he could just make out the suggestion of a road that had become overgrown long ago. As the man turned onto this old road with a smile at once wistful and serene, a voice came down from the heavens to ask, "Where are you going?" Stopping in his tracks, the man looked up as, with a rustle of branches, a boy of 10 dropped to the ground from an apple tree. The eyes of the old man widened. "You're as silent as a mouse, young man." With a look of self-assurance, the boy took the man's remark very much as a compliment. "I am too," said a timid voice from among the leaves. The traveller looked up to discover a girl of 7 or 8 perched on a branch.
"Indeed you are. Would you like a hand coming down?"
"I don't need one," said the girl. But she angled herself to drop into the traveller's arms, just the same. Once the girl was on the ground beside the boy, the traveller could see that the two were siblings.
"We're pirates,"
the boy said matter-of-factly, while looking off toward the horizon.
"I could tell," said the man.
"Are you going to the mansion?"
the little girl asked with curiosity.
"Most no one goes there," cautioned the boy. "Where is it?"
the man asked, having seen no sign of it through the trees.
"We'll show you."
The boy and girl led the man along the old overgrown road, which turned into a long, lazy arc. After they had walked about 10 minutes, the mystery of the mansion's invisibility was solved. For having been burned to the ground decades before, it consisted now of 2 tilting chimneys at either end of a clearing still dusted here and there with ash. If one has been absent for decades from a place that one once held dear, the wise would generally counsel that one should never return there again. History abounds with sobering examples. After decades of wandering the seas and overcoming all manner of deadly hazards, Odysseus finally returned to Ithaca, only to leave it again a few years later. Robinson Crusoe, having made it back to England after years of isolation, shortly thereafter set sail for that very same island from which he had so fervently prayed for deliverance. Why, after so many years of longing for home, did these sojourners abandon it so shortly upon their return? It is hard to say. But perhaps for those returning after a long absence, the combination of heartfelt sentiments and the ruthless influence of time can only spawn disappointments. The landscape is not as beautiful as one remembered it. The local cider is not as sweet. Quaint buildings have been restored beyond recognition, while fine old traditions have lapsed to make way for mystifying new entertainments. And having imagined at one time that one resided at the very center of this little universe, one is barely recognized, if recognized at all. Thus do the wise counsel that one should steer far and wide of the old homestead. But no counsel, however well grounded in history, is suitable for all. Like bottles of wine, two men will differ radically from each other for being born a year apart or on neighboring hills. By way of example, as this traveller stood before the ruins of his old home, he was not overcome by shock, indignation, or despair. Rather, he exhibited the same smile, at once wistful and serene, that he had exhibited upon seeing the overgrown road. For as it turns out, one can revisit the past quite pleasantly, as long as one does so, expecting nearly every aspect of it to have changed. Having wished the young pirates well, our traveller made his way into the local village about 5 miles away. Though he didn't mind seeing that so many of the old landmarks had disappeared, he was greatly relieved to find that the inn at the edge of the town was still there. Ducking his head as he came through the front door and taking his rucksack from his shoulder, he was greeted by the innkeeper, a middle-aged woman who appeared from the back, wiping her hands on her apron. She asked if he was looking for a room. He confirmed that he was, but said he'd like to have something to eat first. So she gestured with her head toward the doorway that led to the tavern. Ducking his head again, he went inside. Given the hour, there were but a few citizens seated here and there at the old wooden tables, eating a simple stew of cabbage and potatoes, or drinking a glass of vodka. Offering a friendly nod to those who bothered to look up from their meals, the man headed to the little room with the old Russian stove at the back of the tavern. And there in the corner, at a table for two, her hair tinged with grey, the willowy woman waited. This is Nicholas Guy Smith. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. This program was directed by Linda Korn. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2016 by Cetology, Inc. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.